Would anyone like to share anything about the meditation or ask anything?
So I'm preparing for this exam, which is pretty okay. Can you hear me now? Yeah. So I'm preparing for this exam, which is a little tough, and I'm really working hard towards it. And I started off very aware that the result is not in my hands, and the only thing that I can do now is just be in the present moment and study. But somewhere down the line, there's a wish that this work translates into the result that I'm hoping for, and I don't know where to, how to tell myself that that's. I just have to drop the expectation.
But it would be quite natural to wish for a good result, especially when one knows one is putting in hard work. Nothing wrong in that. It doesn't need any correction.
But then I get disappointed if something doesn't go my way.
That is the human experience. But disappointment may arise. Perhaps you don't get the results you thought you would. Still nothing wrong. But you don't blame and condemn and hate yourself anymore if the results are lower than what you expected. That is the only difference. Wishing for a good result, who would not want to wish? Being disappointed is natural, but the problem is not the disappointment in the moment. The problem is this weight which the result, which is not according to our expectations, carries with it. This burden of guilt, shame, hatred for oneself. The rest, what you have said, are natural movements in life. But the psychological burden which we carry is, I am responsible for the poor result. It is as simple as that. Does that help in any way? So, this is not a quest for perfection and not feeling human emotions, but not being embroiled in them. There is this misconception of a spiritual perfection and a spiritual ideal. And there are a lot of spiritual centers or organizations which push people towards this ideal. And here the ideal is a total acceptance of the will of God, which results in peace and harmony in daily living. There's a nice new book come out by someone who follows these teachings. It is called The Eternal Truth in the Light of Sikhism. I was just reading it yesterday, parts of it, where the author says that he belongs to a family of eye doctors and he had no interest in becoming an eye doctor himself. And so when he had to give the exams, he was demotivated because his passion didn't lie there. And to his surprise, he did very well. And he's an eye doctor. So these things happen. Where we are meant to go, we will go, whether we like it or not. And things will unfold. Now what? Now that you accept that you may have had a certain plan, but life has moved you somewhere else, now what? Will you suffer psychologically that this is not what I had planned for myself? Or will you accept the divine will and say, all right, here I am. I didn't choose it. It chose me. Any suffering we are facing, whether it is financial, emotional, physical, we don't choose it, it chooses us. Yes, now what? We have to face it. Attempts to avoid it destroy our peace. We have to accept the will of God and also resisting it as the will of God. Resistance is also seen as a movement, that something here is resisting this situation. Even that is seen. Wherever there is resistance, there is the ego. And the thing is, what is your name? Devika. Devika, the thing is, if you got far better results than you thought you would, you'd have no problem. You see, that is how we are designed. Everything is the will of God. If God is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-pervading, can anything be apart from it? But resistance is the ego with its sense of doership, which feels I am in control. So it resists the fact that someone else is. So resistance is not apart from the will of God, but it is seen that the resistance is causing me to suffer psychologically. And my peace is to be found when there is no resistance. So resistance is directly connected to the ego. It exposes the ego for wanting to be in control of a situation. So I cannot have peace if I'm resisting. And this is the quest for peace. So when resistance comes up, it is an opportunity to explore it. Even this opportunity is provided by God only, nobody else, you see. That is actually quite a blessing in that sense, that we know that our suffering, psychological suffering, is connected to our resistance. Yet we are given the awareness that it is connected to our resistance. And then by and by, when we rest in this understanding, so this is not an attempt to stop resisting and pushing ourselves, but when resistance comes up and we see it in this light of clarity, then that resistance stops having a hold on us like it used to. That is what happens. The more we try to stop the resistance, the more we reinforce it. Because the ego loves to do. So now it thinks, I can even stop myself resisting. So it has caught its own tail. It loves to do that. And when it lets go, all right, let the resistance come, let's see it for what it is. Then you are not mesmerized by it anymore. It loses that allure.
Also talk about using spirituality as a way of escapism. Like, you know, sometimes just to escape things, this feels good. And then you don't feel like doing anything and you just hold on to it and I don't know.
Can you give me one example?
Like, maybe you don't feel like doing anything in terms of work, relationships, whatever. You just want to be in the zone. I don't know if that's a way of escaping life. And if you're doing that, then how do you get out of it?
I don't know. Let's say you're a multimillionaire and you can afford to be in the zone, be in the zone. So simple. Otherwise, yes, a large part of it is escapism and bypassing. Life is too challenging, so I want to escape from things. And I find comfort in the spiritual journey because it gives me a license. That is also the ego. Wherever, whatever I'm escaping from, is exposing myself. This we have to be very careful about. Whether I'm escaping from relationships, work maybe, anything. Am I escaping from something? See, one stream of spirituality is where you are convinced from childhood that you want to be a monk. Nothing else matters. And so you have lost all interest in this world and you go to an ashram in the Himalayas and you live the rest of your life there. That is one way. But for those of us who are in the world, in homes, navigating relationships, life situations, the mundane world, this becomes our ashram. And through this ashram, we learn about life. So now, whatever you escape in this world might just come running after you, you see, till it is recognized that you are escaping from it. And when you stop escaping and you turn around, it's not chasing you anymore. So we will know deep in our hearts whether we are actually escaping a life situation and taking kind of the spiritual path to avoid something. Maybe to avoid family, maybe to avoid working, maybe to avoid human relationships which bog me down. We know within our hearts what it is that we are trying to escape from. Ultimately, we are trying to escape from ourselves. Because the burden of being me is too much. Yet it is also a movement which has the stamp of God. Because we may be in a situation we are tired of. So we try to find succor in the spiritual dimension. Could be. But this teaching is one which is not a crutch. It will not allow you to lean on it as an escape. It will make you turn around and face destiny. And when you face destiny, it will give you the strength of deep peace while you face it. So that whatever is allotted to you in this birth till the last breath, as Shirdi Sai Baba would say, your prarabdha karma, even I can't change. Although he did in some instances, but by and large he told people this. So to face one's lot with peace, equanimity and calm, which are qualities of the self, not of the ego. The ego is strife, disturbance, psychological suffering. This teaching enables one to face that, not run away or escape from it.
Is there a way to...
Is there a way to heighten the awareness? Because what happens is, I've been listening to Rameshji since at least 3-4 years, and of course listening to you also. There are times life is going so much in peace and loving being in that moment. And there are times it just, such a big storm comes. In a such a fraction of minor things, moving thing from here to here, and the ego comes up. So in that moment, the awareness, many times it happens that for hours, awareness is saying that it had to happen, it was your destiny. Ego is not ready to do anything. And there are times awareness doesn't even come right away. How do I heighten the awareness? So as soon as things arise, and I would say that, oh, I need to just move on the side and let it flow.
Try. All we can do is try.
Is there any process that can heighten our awareness towards it?
You see, what happens is the new conditioning is what does this work. The sadhana could just be introspection and contemplation. Anything which happens, which disturbs my peace, I ask myself, what just happened? How did I lose my peace?
I just cry.
So that is the sadhana, you see. And
I feel so helpless.
Exactly, because you have decades of conditioning behind you, right, since birth. It cannot be erased overnight, but the earnestness is there.
Yeah.
That is all one can hope for and keep trying. But not to try too hard, just like we spoke about in meditation.
No, I got it.
To see that this is a human trait which I have. Okay, tell yourself, I slipped up again. So be it. Thy will be done. And by and by, it is the awareness which steps in on its own. By and by.
So when the awareness or the teachings that I've been listening to is bombarding its those sentences that has worked on myself, and I know that this is the way to gain the peace, those sentences are going back of my mind, I'm talking to myself, and the ego doesn't want to listen at all. What do you do during that time?
You can't do anything.
Yeah.
What can you do?
Yeah, I know.
But yes, it may show you which parts of life and yourself you're not willing to let go of. See, awareness is always present. Pure being, pure consciousness is right here, right now in totality. Awareness does not step in as such. It's just a way of speaking. When this ego with its sense of doership starts dissolving more and more and more, awareness is allowed to shine in its brightest capacity because the darkness is of the ego.
Okay.
You see? Imagine you were the child of 6 years old. Were you able to judge anyone or anything?
And even if I judged, I didn't care.
Okay.
Yeah. Because
that child
was a way of living.
That child is inside there now. But the ego, with its life's experiences, the way its parents treated it, siblings treated it, friends treated it,
I think now the spirituality teaching is becoming hindrance.
It could be.
Yeah.
But this child consciousness, the ego which became encrusted over time, does it mean that the child consciousness is not there? Because child consciousness is pure being.
Yes.
Without pure being, you'd be dead.
Of course.
You're alive.
Of course.
So that pure being of the six-year-old is right here, right now also.
Agreed.
So the darkness is of the ego. So what in my spiritual journey created these hardwired belief systems, which I am really heavily invested in, which make me snap at the slightest thing? I have to ask myself that. and to then expose it, that my cherished view or opinion or something was so dear to me that I could not bear someone saying something or doing something, and that is what made me snap. But one needs honesty for that. So this is really not an attempt to increase awareness, but to see things as they are.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Makes sense.
Because now the application part comes, right?
That's all I could say that, yeah.
You and me are wearing the same color scheme. Yet, if I ask myself, am I more at peace today than I was earlier? That gives me a good indication.
Of course, oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So then one should not be too hard on oneself.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the overarching question to ask, like compared to a year ago, 5 years ago, whatever it may be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where I am today, am I more at peace than earlier?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you see, what happens is, the spiritual, when this drive to merge with the source is so strong, even the slightest impediments become very big. The slightest transgressions of ours appear like mountains. But in unawareness, we didn't care about them.
So true. So true.
They were like small pebbles. So you stepped over someone, big deal.
Yeah.
Now, so my God, how did I say that and do that?
So true.
So see how the perspective has changed.
Yeah. So how does meditation help in this journey? If everything is destined to happen, as Rameshji says, that from birth till you die, it's the reel in the movie is in the can. How would meditation help?
If you live this understanding, then your life is a living meditation.
Okay. No, I'm talking about the meditation that we do like this.
I started by saying that this quality of witnessing permeates daily living. That is how it helps.
Okay.
But if you have reached that point in daily living where you are witnessing all the events which transpire in the day, you don't need to sit for meditation because meditation is happening throughout the day.
Got it.
Then there's no difference between sitting for half an hour and your entire day.
Yes.
Hello, Master. I don't know if I ask you this privately, but I think it can be beneficial for all of us to know. If the ego, you see it like rising a few times, and if that happens, if you have an inner dialogue with the ego, or you just witness the presence and allow it to, let's say, go back, like how is your approach if that happens?
There is no inner dialogue with the ego, because that would make two egos. No, what I mean is, you know, it's me talking with myself, but the second thing, this witnessing the antics of the ego, as I say, that is exposed. But it really doesn't matter. Whatever works for anyone, whatever technique or tool, as long as the end game is peace of mind. So it's really quite okay. Even something else may be there, which you haven't thought of, I haven't thought of. But as long as it's clear that whatever I'm employing is finding me going towards that peace, that is all that matters. That is the main thing.
It was the first statement that you said, that two dialogues. That is what usually I experience during meditation. That there's some second dialogue which is stopping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The voice in the head.
Yeah, the voice.
Which is telling me how to behave, how not to behave, what I should do, what I should not do. But then there's the voice in the heart. That is different. That is a knowing that is not being processed through the mind. It's like there's a situation and you already know something about it, your feeling, which is not depending on the thinking mind.
This is what they call intuition?
Could be.
I've never experienced.
You may not even know that you experienced it.
So from my experience, what I'm seeing, especially after meeting the teaching, you know, is that, let's say, the ego as the voice in the head comes and has, like, I don't know, a judgment about something, like, why did he or she behave in such a way? Then it's almost like from another side, like, the teaching comes in and it says, because it's God's will. And then the ego, like, just goes back.
That is the teaching.
Yeah. Like, from the heart.
Absolutely.
You mentioned, yeah.
Absolutely. That is the fresh conditioning.
Yeah.
the voice of the fresh conditioning. Old conditioning thinks a certain way, fresh conditioning arises. And then that fresh conditioning overtakes daily living. Everything is seen in light of that. Nothing is excluded.
So is that is what you're trying to say, that if everything's God will, there's no free will? Do we have free will of choice? So I don't have the power to make my own. So if I make a choice that's not my choice, that God's choice.
Well, because your choice is based on your conditioning and your nature, both of which you didn't create. God did. Did you create your conditioning? The way your parents treated you, did you guide them how they should treat you? So your conditioning at home, with your siblings, the school you went to, the religion you belong to, the economic status of your parents shaped you. And your innate nature, whether you were boisterous as a child, timid as a child. And on the basis of all this, you had a view. You took decisions. And so you thought you had free will. But life kept teaching you that the results have never been in your control. Then you start wondering, do I really have free will? And if I'm convinced I do, it's really not worth much in any case, because I can't control people, I can't control situation, I can't control anything. So what is the worth of this free will? You see?
Free will, if it aligns with what you wish, but after all that...
Whether it aligns or not, both are God's will. Ultimately, yes, but I still have to walk through life acting as if I have free will, because that is the mechanism of functioning in daily living.
So now, sir, I'm working in an organization and I'm doing my bit. I'm working hard, I'm dedicated, whatever, you know, I'm doing my bit. So then if I was like, oh, it's God's ki will, theek hai, mujhe kya karna hai? Matlab, ho jayega.
So do it.
So nahi, sir,
then you have to face the consequences of this line of approach.
So free will to hoga hi na, sir?
Yes, as a mechanism of functioning in daily living.
As a mechanism of functioning in daily living.
You have to take decisions.
Yeah, you have.
Supposing you are going for job interviews.
Yeah.
You are approved by two organizations. You have to decide which of the two to go for.
Now, this is my question. Now, that choice, is it free will or is it God's will?
So, you have to act as if you have free will. You choose one over the other.
Yeah.
It may or may not work out. Either way, it is God's will. Because your so-called free will... The choice you made is based on factors beyond your control. Yet you have to make a choice.
So
as I keep saying, let's say you go to a shop. Mm-hmm. You want to buy a gift for yourself, a nice, beautiful dress.
Yeah.
You see two which you like.
Yeah.
You can afford only one.
Okay.
You will have to choose which of the two.
Exactly.
Now you see a yellow dress, you see a blue dress.
Mm-hmm.
You say, I'll go for the yellow one.
Mm-hmm.
Was that really your choice, or did it appear like that because something made you like yellow more than blue?
Exactly.
What was that?
My subconscious.
A preference.
A preference, okay, yeah.
You see, on which you acted.
Right.
So, isn't it clear that free will is just a mechanism of choosing one of the two dresses? But what is your preference based on? Why did you choose yellow over blue? Can you answer?
Because it's much brighter.
For you.
And I like it.
For you.
But actually, yes, yellow is my favorite color. It's true.
You see, in this book, the Sikhism book, there's a nice story where Guru Nanak is asked by a man who is laboring in the fields this question about free will.
Yeah.
I am laboring in the fields, working hard. And Guru Nanak replies, but whether it rains or not is not in your control. So all you can do is do what you think you should do. But do you really have free will? Because if you did, you could also have the outcome of the crops.
Right. So if let's say I make a choice in life and that choice does not turns out to be the outcome that it ideally should be, then I shouldn't blame myself
exactly,
for the choices.
Exactly, because it is not my free will. So I don't carry the burden of the outcome, which is what we just discussed.
Because you tend to beat ourselves that why did I choose this if I had known
exactly.
Better. I wish I had not. I would have been more conscious. I would have been more aware.
Yeah.
But then...
It's so simple. So this is not to negate free will. This is to see free will as a mechanism I need to employ in daily living. But I'm no longer placing it on the pedestal which I was earlier.
Because the outcome is not in...
Outcome is not in my control, and even free will is truly not my free will, but God's will operating through me. Because God has designed me a certain way. Yet, the consequences of my so-called free will I have to face. Time lagega. Time lagega, because we have been programmed to believe that free will is this hero in our life.
हाँ कि मेरे पास तो power of choice है.
है, you do have the power of choice, but it is exposed as being quite a worthless power. The problem was the worth we attributed to it, whereas the power of choice is just a mechanism. That is all, because the power of choice is my power. That is the problem. That is what causes suffering. I decided. The problem is that.
And when I decided and it didn't work out, then I blame myself,
yes,
which I shouldn't.
Yes, exactly. Because your peace is destroyed. Which is what the whole Bhagavad Gita is about. Whole Bhagavad Gita is about this only. When Krishna tells Arjuna, you think you are exercising your choice by putting your bow and arrow down. You are behaving as if you have a very high level of morality. When your whole destiny and life path was to be a warrior, trained to be a warrior, you were designed to fight. Now you are saying, I decide not to fight. More importantly, it's irrelevant because as time, I have already killed them. So what was Krishna pointing to? You have to do what is your dharma. The way you have been designed, results not in your control. Same thing.
So here the takeaway is that although I feel like I'm making the choice, and the outcome is not in my control, it's actually not me making the choice, it's a higher...
You could say
intelligence
that.
...intelligence making a choice,
yes,
through me.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Can pass the mic. Can we have one AC on?
I got them. The question is about, you know, what you answered, that am I running away from the situation or am I trying to escape life? But by and by, as you start valuing peace, because you're experiencing it more now, there are some relationships or situations you're not interested in naturally. So there's some argument and you just let it be. You don't invest in it. Is that also escaping?
See, as long as it is resolved in your consciousness, you have to ask yourself, is it resolved internally or am I actually resisting something? Then I will know. If it is not resolved internally, then I'm escaping. As long as it is resolved internally,
which I want at the end of the matter, whether it's or it doesn't happen, I'm still like, you know, not very interested. I'm not in, like, suppose I have an argument with you, okay? And basically the argument goes because I want something to happen on my terms or my way. But if I'm not interested, only I said, let it go.
If you feel you're not interested, so be it.
So be it, right?
Yeah. But if that...
it does matters, then it... I
if
have to question
that is
my...
a resistance,
yeah,
then you have to see within.
Yeah, because even I was having the same conflict. Sometimes we do have challenges in relationship, right?
Of course.
And sometimes we just feel it's okay. It's okay if I don't get what I desire, it's okay. Rather than creating a conflict, I'd rather stay with the peace which I already have.
Yes, but you must ask yourself, if that peace has the potential of being disturbed, what is it that is disturbing it?
Can you say again?
See, there may be an ego in your life.
Yes.
Who has what Eckhart Tolle calls an active pain body, who's always out to fight with you. Okay? Now, within yourself, if you are resolved that this person is not the doer of their actions, is playing out their script, then your consciousness is resolved. You have understood the whole dynamic. Right? Now, when you know deep down that this person does not have the power to take away your peace, because your peace is a resolved peace, it does not mean you have to subject yourself to this person again and again. You may feel that these conversations are pointless, right? That is your conclusion. So it's best to avoid them. That is fine. But within, you have to be clear that, am I choosing to keep quiet because my peace is being disturbed and internally I have a resistance point to this person and what they are saying, or is it resolved?
Oh, if I can put it in this way, whether I'm still condemning them,
That is one way. If you realize there's no condemnation, so be it. Then you have to choose, you have to exercise your free will. Do I stay away from such a person if I have the choice?
Mm. Yeah, it's more important what I hold against them.
Yes, you could say that.
Yeah. Mm.
If you still blame them, condemn them, judge them.
Yeah, this is what happened. Because that is actually the deeper rooted, which is cause distress, if I could say that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
But if by nature your relationship is resolved with someone who's, as far as you are concerned, always targeting you, so to speak, you're free to exercise a choice. As Eckhart Tolle would say, either you walk away if you have the option, or just be with it if there's no option. But either way, that peace is no longer shaken like it used to be. So I made a list I'd like to read out. I was thinking of all the people who deeply impacted me, but who I met physically, not who are not in the body. I mean, they may not be in the body now, but at some point I met them. So I wanted to just read out this list, actually for myself. So first, of course, is my mother, Santosh Ma, who was my teacher since I was born. And my father, who was here briefly. Everyone's parents are their first teachers, nothing special. But to acknowledge that. Then my guru, Ramesh Balsekar. Then Eckhart Tolle, who was a big influence in my life. And I really cherished the times I met him, which was quite often over a period of about 4 years. Then I have various masters I met along the way, like Yogi Raj Gurunath, who taught me a lot. Peter Bowers, who I met physically only once in England, but that was a very pivotal point for me. He was extremely clairvoyant, intuitive. And I remember going to meet him. It just happened that I had visited a town called Exeter in England. And he stayed 45 minutes away from there in a town called Torquay. So I was supposed to talk to him on the phone. But when we discovered that he was 45 minutes away, so I said, I'll come to you. He said, no, I'll come to you because you've come all the way from Bombay to meet me. I said, I haven't. I've come because I'm on holiday. And he said, you may think so. So that was a very beautiful... Are my spectacles here? Okay. Sorry. Huh. And he told me things which at that time were very far-fetched, but they unfolded with time. So I really appreciate that interaction. Then my mother's disciple, Rohit Arya, who kind of, we started our journeys together. His path was the Kundalini because he was awakened through working on my mother's books. But even before that, I learned a lot from him about Indian mythology, about scriptures, about various things. And when I didn't know him well at that time, I had gone to him for tarot reading. He was very good at tarot. And he didn't know me. And he opened the cards and he said, I think you were supposed to be born in Europe, but then you got shunted to India last minute. Then someone I have known for a long time, quite a mysterious person called Yogesh Bhai Vitlani, who was an intuitive, he did many things, face reading, astrology, intuition, clairvoyance, who was really a kind of, I learned so much from him about navigating life a certain way. And he kept insisting that I learn astrology because I'd be very good at it, but I have no interest in it. So every time we meet, which is very little now, his first thing is, Sikho, Baitho. So he'll make me sit by his side and he'll tell me, this is in that house, that is in that house. And I still can't figure out that diagram. What is in which house, I have no idea. First house, second house, third house, fourth house. So... But he has really been quite amazing. Then I spent many Sunday evenings with Maharaja's translator Mullar Patan, and I learned different things from him about Maharaj, about anecdotes which my guru perhaps had no interest in sharing because his focus was the teaching. So I kind of felt closer to Maharaj because of Mullar Patan. Then someone I met, Master Charles Cannon, who was a disciple of Muktananda, who visited India a couple of times, and his interactions were quite profound. His was the group which had two members killed in the terrorist attacks in Mumbai. And his right-hand man, Alan Sher, who died in the attacks, he used to sit in my office and do his work. And he was with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And he was a Vedic astrologer for over 25 years. So my brief interactions with him over chai, I learned a lot. All these people came. They somehow crossed my path. Master Charles Cannon had a lot of clarity. And he taught me a little bit about the dream world and how to interpret dreams, which was quite fascinating. And missed the opportunity to visit him in his ashram in the US, but that was a deep influence. Then my guru's brother, Ramesh Balsekar's brother, Chetan Balsekar, who I have seen, I used to see him right from satsang days. I would, after satsang, go across to his house. It was opposite. And even after my guru passed, I would meet him often. Who was basically, as far as his brother was concerned, a co-disciple of Nisargadatta Maharaj, because it was Rameshji who sent Chetan to see whether this guy called Maharaj was really worth visiting. So Chetanji went and came back and told Ramesh that, yes. So if he had not done that, Ramesh would not have gone. You see? So I keep telling him, I said, you recognized Maharaj first, not Ramesh. That is how it works. Everything is connected. Then I would like to acknowledge all the Sufi masters of Kashmir. I used to be drawn to Kashmir as a child. I didn't know why, but I think now I do. And to begin with, there was Qadir Saab, who was really a phenomenon. Then Badshah Shafi, who taught me a lot. Dr. Altaf, who I met very briefly. Muhammad Latif, who, again, it was so touching because this man, I made one trip to meet him, which was about 2.5 hours away from Srinagar. And the second time I met him, I was supposed to meet him in Srinagar and I could not meet him. So I felt quite bad. It was okay. And the third time, it was really strange because every time I was visiting Srinagar, he was also visiting at that time and he stayed 10 minutes away. And so two instances happened where because of social engagements, I could not meet him. And I felt very bad the second time. So I promised him that whenever he's in Srinagar and I'm there, we'd meet. And to my surprise, the person who introduced me to him said, I just want you to know that after your first visit to him, both the times he's come only to meet you. He had not come to meet his other disciples in Srinagar. So this for me was a big lesson. Genuine teachers don't boast. They just make themselves available and you won't even know. That was very touching for me. So these small things I have learned from. And a lady peer called Khatija, who I have met recently but feel I've known since lifetimes. Then there's Yogi Raj Amarjyoti, who I met maybe 3 times. And it's been very beautiful meeting him. Very giving person. The first time I met him, he made us perform a havan in his ashram, which he was actually performing for his close devotees who were living with him. So he's been someone I have learned from. Then Damini Ben Jariwala, who is a 95-year-old disciple of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo, who kind of reinforced for me things I already knew. So this is, I don't think I've missed anyone, but largely these are the people who I've learned a lot from. But of course, it begins and ends with the parampara of Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj, Nisar Datta Maharaj, and Ramesh Balsekar. So for me, that circle is complete. The rest, you could say, based on one's past, one comes across certain people, encounters, and one learns.
There's so many temples around. So what really fascinates you? Do you feel like this? Like, though people say, like, you know, just sitting by yourself, you should get that experience, that feeling. Yet, you know, people are drawn to going to these places where they feel that they're going to feel some kind of... So I wanted to know about your journey, because while I was reading, I just see, like, you know, you visited quite a few places around in India and otherwise. So
mine is a bit odd. I would not use that as the template, because I had no interest in visiting temples. It was mainly through visions and dreams that names came to me. So I thought the logical conclusion is to go there and finish what has to be finished. But you see, temples represent deities which are aspects of consciousness. Some are male, some are female aspects. Like the Shakti Peets are female. Shiva temples are there. Krishna temples are there. So people are pulled to that aspect of consciousness which resonates with them. Unless, of course, they're going to all temples with a begging bowl and saying, you know, give me this relationship, give me this money, give me this, give me that. I never went to temples with that approach, because life taught me early on not to ask only. So I just kind of went and presented myself. That's the best way I can express it. That you've called me here, here I am. I had no ask except for good health, you could say, for loved ones. But beyond that, nothing emerged to ask. There was no... it was not a need-based relationship to visit a temple. If there was a calling, then one went. But they are powerful energies. People do tap into them. They make shifts. They create shifts in certain people. So it all depends. It depends on each person's makeup. It's not that everyone should go to temples. None of that. My mother never had an interest purely in going to temples. So it's a very personal thing.
Even if it's desire to go, because you feel you're going to feel something there, that's all right.
Yeah, and you may or may not feel it. That we don't know. But even if you don't feel it, doesn't mean it's not working on you. You see? We want that direct thing. Cause-effect relationship. We want the barter system. Just like we want in love. I love you, so you must love me. Best is to go with no expectation. So I go with no expectation and come back with nothing. Beautiful. Who knows whether one is coming back with nothing or not? One will never know. But go with no expectation.
And expect the unexpected.
That life is going to teach you. You don't need temples for that. No slap in life is expected, right? You don't think that, I think I will be slapped tomorrow.
This thing which you said, you know, I mean, I personally feel everything is a result of grace. You know, we don't really do anything, and everything great that happens to us is a function of grace. And the literal definition of grace is also unmerited favors from God.
Yes. And where did you read that?
In Wayne's book. And he speaks a lot about that. And I think, you know, we tend to miss that. We want to change so many things. We think we can accelerate our journey. We can do so many things, but it's all grace, you know. And maybe just acknowledging that is the real
well said
transformation.
Very well said. You
know? Because even when I look at my life, I didn't know I was going to get on the spiritual journey. It came unmerited. I don't think I deserved it. And just happened.
Yeah.
With business, with any deal that happens. I don't know where my role is, you know. And when I try to do something, the opposite happens.
No, and with deals which went wrong, we learn so much.
Yeah.
So even that is grace.
That is also.
Grace is not that everything has gone right. That even the wrong is the life lesson to be learned. That is grace.
But it does make you realize how compassionate the universe is, because you really feel like, okay, what have I done to like deserve so much, you know, and so much has happened. And just acknowledging that, like, really brings a shift.
It's true. Very true. Because that's why I say be happy and joyful that you've discovered something in life.
Mm.
That is a celebration, yeah? I mean, I think it's a great feeling to know that you are more at peace now than you were earlier. It gets overlooked because it's not alluring. It's great joy. It's so joyful when you realize a situation didn't shake you up like you would have got shaken up 3 years earlier. That is joyful.
And that we didn't do. It's grace.
It's grace.
It's grace. We didn't do anything.
No, because that which made you more peaceful was not in your hands. Yeah. It came your way.
Yeah, in a way, the question might have already been answered, but I'm just wondering from a guru's point of view, is there, can a disciple disappoint them? Because disciples or students might carry this guilt that they might not be doing enough.
Sure, sure.
And yeah.
But you'll have to ask a guru that. See, the guru is the higher self of the disciple. Can the higher self be disappointed? This is a quality of the ego. The guru is not having those thought processes in mind. Because the guru is at ease. See, yes, what can happen in traditional systems is that if a disciple is behaving a way which is not conducive to the Sangha or to the teachings, the guru may ask or tell that disciple that this is not where you belong, please move. That is possible. But otherwise, how is it possible? It's not possible only for a guru to feel that the disciple has let them down, if that's what you're asking.
So in that case, the student's role would be to let go of this notion or
yes.
be at peace.
Unless the student themselves is confused. You know, if the student feels that this person is not my guru, then they have the free will to go elsewhere. That the guru cannot control.
Mm-hmm.
But that feeling of disappointment, like I feel I have disappointed my guru, is invalid. That is just the ego again coming through the back door and judging itself.
Yeah.
It's like I feel guilty for not getting 4 on 10. That is just the egoic dialogue. So for example, you know that this person is your guru. It's absolutely clear the peace you have felt there, the love, the respect, all the boxes are ticked. But you are feeling that you've disappointed your guru because you have evaluated yourself. You have written an exam and you're also the person who's checking the marks, giving the marks. That is what has happened. Yes, you are disappointed in yourself because you're not able to live the teachings. Okay, so you strive to live them because your old conditioning is so strong, it's taking time. That is okay. That is part of the sadhana. But that does not equate to the guru being disappointed.
Makes sense,
yeah. Yeah? All right. There's some prasad for everyone, some small chocolates, so please have that. Will someone distribute it?